See this continuation, tape two of the interview with Dr. Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure.
Dr. Tom Conley. Until this last year, these Alaska Native Health Service doctors worked in the Ketchikan Hospital, but at that time, a clinic building was built for them. They have been joined by Dr. Lee Ellward, Shields, Hardison, and Barrett. Dr. Ty Salinas, an internist, joined the Wilson Clinic 2 years ago. Dr. William Anthus, this last year. Dr. Ron Tokar, ophthalmologist. Dr. Richard Babcock in the 1970s and obstetrics and gynecology. Dr. Gary Carlson and Dr. J. Joseph Shields, the one in hand and reconstructive surgery and the other in orthopedics, have been here for the last few years. That is the end of this report. Unless there's something else you want to ask me to do.
Well, I have a few things still.
Yeah.
When did you, when did you sort of start going from a house call practice to an office-based practice?
Well, we didn't actually go from house calls until about 3 or 4 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Of course, it didn't make so much difference to me. How old am I now? I'm 84. I stopped going out the office when I was 80. Now, for 3 or 4 years there, the boys would say, look, come out 2 afternoons a week and let's go with that, don't try and do it anymore. And I didn't try to do any house calls just longer than that before I didn't. I'm going to go on that before I do the house call. But they decided that they just were going to have to stop doing it, stop making a call, that there just wasn't time enough in the day to do it.
So,
and that's what happened when it kind of fell into place.
Your sons, when they joined you, they were making house calls too?
Yeah. I remember back here in 1952 or so, there was a young fellow here named Clark who had a fellow practice, and he wasn't making any house calls. And I said, well, how in the world do you manage this? How do you manage it? He said, oh, he said, they could all get down to my office. Nobody's ever died because they couldn't have some friend bring him down in a car.
Well, were the other physicians making house calls, or two, or?
At that time, yeah, at that time they were. Just this one guy was the only one who wasn't. I don't know how in the world he managed to do it without making any. I never was able to. But tonight. I know that I have several times gone out the office to get checked on for something that I wouldn't have asked a patient to do, say, 30 years ago. I would have just thought it was too much of an ordeal for that patient. Yet I did it myself later when I and it didn't seem to hurt me, so. And I do know that you can get a whole lot more done if your patient is there in the office. And
yeah,
but there were some things about this house call business that kind of stuck with you, you know. I ran in some incident in somebody's life and get a different slant on how this guy was trying to cope with his troubles. And
you mean that you'd get that from making house, yeah, by making house, yeah, calls? Yes, I can see that.
I know every once in a while I've driven by some house and suddenly I just happen to remember something that happened there years ago. Yeah.
You have two sons?
Yeah.
That's your...
Yeah, Jim is 54. Yeah, Jim is 54 and Art's 50. Art must be 49. Well, Art was born up there at Kennicott. I had to deliver him. And that's...
Well, you say you delivered him?
Yeah, I had to deliver him. My wife didn't want to get on Seattle by herself. And you know, it used to take a long time to travel.
Oh, I know.
You took the, ordinarily, if you had to take the train from Kennicott to Cordova, that was 2 days, and five on the steamship. Yeah.
Airplanes have made a lot of difference, haven't they?
Yeah, I should say. When I went up first, I remember some of these, I'd say, here's this old guy over here, John Jones, and they'd say, yeah, but he's one of these old timers. He got seasick when he came up here. He won't go south again.
I can appreciate that too. You know, one of the things people always talk about in Alaska is the isolation. You know, how do you feel about that medically? You know, I am not very familiar, to tell you the truth, with Southeast, and you know, you're a lot closer to Seattle here than Anchorage or Fairbanks. But you know, did you feel medically isolated when you were practicing here?
Not here. Up there.
In Kennicott.
Oh boy, I didn't have anybody to talk to up there.
There was no phone, no telephone,
well,
either.
I don't mean that, but I mean in a medical way. I had three nurses there in the hospital, no doctor to talk to, and I just was isolated. Down here, gosh, in the first place, there's a big staff out here at the hospital. In the second place, there's somebody coming up from Seattle every day or two. We've got either some x-ray specialist coming up to do something, or any other specialist coming up to do something, or Dr. Duncan does a lot of urology up here, and always somebody to talk to.
Well, that's true now, but what about back in, you know, when you first came
when
here?
When I first came here, well, it was, right, yeah, it was isolated. We because if you only have three men here, and one of them never takes a wrapper off of a magazine, you know that he isn't functioning clearly.
Turn your machine up long enough.
Yeah, I think I can do that. Well, maybe I'll just leave it going anyway. We can talk while I... Yeah, it really looks good.
Why, have you talked to anybody else before me?
I've chatted with, this cold gets me.
Sit up a little bit higher.
Yes. In Fairbanks.
James Lundquist.
Yeah, with Lundquist.
Lundquist, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, well, now he ought to have some data for you because he was there for years. He's been there for years.
He's been there since about 1951, I think it was.
And, yeah. So that he ought to.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do, is get an idea of how, you know, things are different here than up there and how they compare. And I, it seems like this medical isolation and trying to keep up could have been a real problem in Alaska.
Yeah, well, it was. Now, there were a couple of these doctors who used to be up there before, well, before 1930. Paul Haglund was an orthopedist who practiced there at Fairbanks Hospital, probably for a good 30 years and maybe longer. I think he didn't get there till 31 maybe or 32, but he was a wonderful, had a lot of ability and a good hard worker, very well thought of, and a great guy to have around. He used to go moose hunting every year. Just a swell fellow. Then there was one named Gillespie. Gillespie had been there. He'd been at Kennicott in the 1920s, before me. Gillespie was had rheumatoid arthritis. He was pretty well crippled up to that. He got in the good graces of the superintendent of Kennicott Corporation. He delivered this man's wife. The baby was fine. So Gillespie got in his good graces right away, and the superintendent came around to him a little later and said, "Look, you go buy some Bonanza stock. Buy all the Bonanza stock you possibly can." So Gillespie went out and begged for it, stole enough money to get all the Bonanza that he could, and then Kennicott acquired Bonanza, and he just made a fortune, you know. Well, they said before 1929, yeah, before the stock market crash, Gillespie was worth $250,000. 3 years later, he was down to $25,000. So, that was when he came up, yeah, in 1932. He came up there that summer, and I met him. he said, well, I'm going to work on the Alaska Railroad this summer. They're going to fix it up and let me have the truck. I'll go up and down the railroad and do the first aid work. I said, well, look, Clasby, I'm stuck here. I can't get away from this place. You know what this is like. You used to be here. How about trading off for a week? So he said, all right. And we traded off for a week, and I took Dagmar and Jim was, what, a couple years old? Anyway, maybe he was older than that. Anyway, well, we went off down the highway and went up as far as Paxton, I think, on the highway. And over to Valdez. I remember going in the drugstore at Valdez and getting the first, got Jim the first ice cream soda that he'd ever had in his life, you know. So we had some fun there. Well, then, about the time I got back from there, there was a murder down on the railroad. And some old man who was a foreman of a section hand was shot in bed. So I had to go down and investigate it. And here was a little bit of a bedroom. This guy lying on the bed with his hands like this behind his neck. And a big Luger lying on the bed. And a bullet right through his aorta here because I had to go do a post on him. So I just said, well, this guy met his death from this revolver and he bled to death there right now, and he didn't have time to get his hands behind his neck after that shot was fired. So they decided to arrest his wife, who was a rather elderly woman, but quite refined. She had a history of, I think this was her sixth husband, and they knew that two of them had died mysterious deaths. But of course, nobody could talk about that. So I had to get home and go to the trial. No, Tony Diamond, a delegate to Congress, had been appointed as, this is before he was a delegate, while he was still a judge up there. He was appointed to defend this woman, which he did. And he had Gillespie there arguing that this guy could have lived as long as there was a drop of blood left in his brain. No matter how fast this was dripping away here, he was still alive as long as there was a drop of blood up here in his brain. So, Diamond said, maybe that Luger that you saw, Doctor, maybe it was up there on a shelf. There was a shelf in that room. Maybe it was up there, maybe it fell off of that thing and hit him in the chest. Well, anyway, that is what the jury accepted, that not only did the Luger fall off accidentally, but that the guy might have been alive an hour or two till the last drop of blood got out.
So, his wife was acquitted, I gather.
Hmm. Yeah. I asked Mr. Diamond one time. I got to know him a lot better after that, because he really was quite nasty to me down there. He wanted to catch me with a textbook, and I kept saying to him, Well, we had mostly notes in that course, which was true. And finally, he picked up a red book. I think there was a physiologist named Starling, same as that bird. And he said something about that, and I said, well, yeah, I know there was a McCoy Starling. So he picked this up and started to read it to me, and I just felt lower all the time as I listened until he got the last line. And the last line saved my neck because it was printed 2 years after I had graduated. But I got quite well acquainted with him afterwards. My wife had met with Matt. She could be at first, you know, she was over there at this trial. And
where was the trial held?
Anchorage.
Oh.
And she was over there, and as soon as I got released, all at once, they came around to me and said, well, if you want to go back to Kennicott tonight, you could. You aren't going to be called on again. And then Tony Diamond came down to tell me to invite us to dinner. And my wife was so damn mad she wouldn't have gone for anything because she thought he'd been very disrespectful to me, you know. But I told her afterward, I said, gee, he had to do that to protect his client, you know, I think anything about it. We got to be very good friends with Tony Diamond. He was a wonderful old guy, and he'd stop here occasionally when the ship went through and come up and have dinner. And
well, when you were here, did you kept up with the latest by subscribing to journals? Was that
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, you bet.
They didn't have all the 1 or 2 day courses back then that they have now, did they?
No. Yeah, we had a number of journals. The tapes, I imagine we started getting tapes probably in the 1950s sometime. We had at least two sets of tapes going all through the 1960s when Tom and Art were here, the Audio Digest, surgical tapes and medical tapes. There would be occasionally somebody would come through here with a lecture for us.
When did that start?
Well, I was trying to think. There was a lot of that going on in the 1960s. A lot of it. And the boys would take turns and go away and go to some course. Of course, the Virginia Mason always had schedule 8 or 10 meetings a year down there. University of Washington, University of Oregon, medical schools would have their programs. Those usually took 2 days down there. From the 1950s on, we kept up with things pretty well. Pretty well.
I know my impression or my feeling, which could be wrong, is there, you know, wasn't all that much progress in medicine from, say, 1930 to 19, you know, mid-50s as there has been in the last 25 years.
Oh, well, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
What kind of pie was that?
Hmm?
What kind of pie was that?
I'll have to ask Magma what it was.
Okay.
I know there's my asking her from here. Her hearing is so bad that she wouldn't get it.
Have you enjoyed practicing medicine?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I've talked to some physicians, you know, who think it's really a bad job because of the long hours, and sometimes there doesn't seem to be too many rewards. I gather that you don't feel that way.
No, gosh, no. I don't know what I'd have done. Really don't.
Well, that must have been transmitted to your son, since they're both in medicine too, huh?
Well, I wish my grandson was, but he decided no. But it really took me quite a while to decide. I really did.
Up in, you know, Anchorage and Fairbanks, a lot of people still seem to think that the medical community isn't competent, and they go down to Seattle. I mean, the Mason Clinic seems to have a strong tie with Alaska. Do a lot of people from around here bypass the local physicians, or?
Well, more than you think, yeah. There are a lot of people who do. On the other hand, we're surprised sometimes at the ones that don't.
I would think the facilities here maybe are not quite as good as they are in Anchorage or Fairbanks. Do you know whether that's true, or?
You'd think what?
That the facilities here are perhaps not as good as they are in Anchorage or Fairbanks, because it is a smaller community.
It's a smaller community. That's true. There is, however, this fact that there are some doctors in some of the smaller places who are just a little bit better mentally and figuring things out than some other group that's in a larger place. I mean, we see that. We see that too. But, there are quite a lot of people who do go south, and we never try to stop anybody who wants to go south. And not only that, but if we think that they're going to get along better down there for a particular accident, illness, why, we just say, look, we think this is what you better do. Now, the Mason Clinic has got they've got a big staff. They've got some excellent doctors there ferreting out problems, and excellent reputation. And they've always been very considerate with people.
Have you referred a lot of patients to the Mason Clinic?
I don't think we've referred as many patients to Mason Clinic as to the other Seattle hospital.
Okay.
I mean, from our office, it's, this isn't on the air here.
Yeah? You not want it to be?
Well, I just don't know how.
You know, another question that, sort of going along with the progress of medicine. Antibiotics made a, you know, with a quantum jump in practice of medicine, I think. What did you do when you didn't have antibiotics?
We didn't have them.
Yeah, I know, you didn't have them until, what, after World War II?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we didn't have them until after World War II.
If it's convenient, yes, please.
Well, by staying in bed and resting and getting a lot of fluids, and that was fine. If they didn't, well, then they just didn't, because nobody had the other. When I graduated from medical school, they said there are subacute bacterial endocarditis and TB meningitis. Nobody ever gets well from either of them. That was 1924. When the war was over, meantime, the last year or two, I had two young fellows with this bacterial endocarditis, and there wasn't a thing I could do except watch them go right down hill like they always had. Well, right after that, were the first antibiotics, then they found it by giving somebody a million units a day for 30 days, it's over. And the TB meningitis, same way. Wasn't penicillin, it was a couple of other things that I was using. But they got over it, and they never had before. They, so there's been a lot of wonderful things happen. I remember going down to an AMA meeting in San Francisco right after the war, and what they said down there was, in the next 3 or 4 years, the advances in heart disease are going to be from surgical methods and not medical methods. And sure enough, they started then doing aneurysm surgery and some of the other open heart surgeries about that time. And then we said we got the other antibiotics, and then we got to having so many antibiotics that you had to be careful what somebody was taking.
Yep.
Or they'd get something they were allergic to.
Thank you.
Or and get in trouble.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember as a child, too, when a person had a heart attack. That was essentially fatal.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't seem to me like very few people survived a heart attack very long, anyway.
Yeah, sometimes I get thinking about some of these patients I have seen during my life. Well, when you said that, I remember a couple of young ladies who were in the OB ward that had their baby, and they had a bacterial endocarditis, and they were just going down the hill as fast as they could.
Yeah.
Fairbanks, be sure you talk to Jim Lundquist. Is Joe Rebar around still?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I haven't seen him for so long. Joe should know all these guys.
Yeah, he's on my list. I haven't contacted him yet.
He should know them. In Anchorage, well, there are a number of men in Anchorage. Now, Robert Wilkins is one.
Yeah, he's on my list.
He was here, I don't know when Bob got here, in the 50s sometime. And Romig, is he up there?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now Romig ought to have some stories for you. Because his father was the Alaska Railroad physician. See, I came up in 1930, Walkowski went to Anchorage, and Romig was there in the Alaska, Romig's father was there with the Alaska Railroad at that time. Now, I never did know the old man. I think I met him once or so, but he practiced up there for years. So, and I don't know if he's still alive or not. He's older than I am, so he may not be. All right, Romig and Wilkinson. Wilkins? It's Wilkins.
Mm-hmm.
Wilkins. Well, Rodman Wilson, say, do you know, I wonder what he's doing. I saw something the other day and it sounded like he might have gone in some administrative work. You know?
No, I don't.
Well, okay. But Rodman Wilson ought to be able to give you some information. And Milo, of course, is over there at Anchor Point. They told this story about Milo after when he got moved up there to Fort Richardson and the war came along, Washington's birthday, and the general put a copy of Washington's farewell address on the bulletin board. So he said Milo came along and looked at it. Then he let out one of his cracks. Well, I always knew it took a long time to get word from Washington, but I didn't think it'd take this long. Now, are you going to stop at Sitka?
No, not now anyway.
Well, did you get in touch with the... Langenba?
Who?
Or Langenba?
No, I haven't.
Do you go through Sitka tomorrow?
Yeah, I do. We do land there.
If you have time to get him on the phone and talk to him, I'd do that and see what he can tell you about Phil Moore.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay, I will do that.
Now, Phil Moore belongs in here because, well, he didn't practice in Ketchikan, he came over to a great many of the clinics. After the war, when he got out of the Navy, he got this job with the Alaska Native Service as their head surgeon. And good gosh, they sent patients down for him from up there in the interior of Alaska. He had a lot of bone and joint tuberculosis over there. And this is one of the few places in the United States where there was any bone or joint tuberculosis.
This was at Mount Edgecombe?
Mount Edgecombe. Along there in the, either the late 40s or early 50s. So then Phil would come over here. Somebody there in Sitka cooked up a Philip Moore orthopedic auxiliary, something like that. And he used to come down here and hold orthopedic clinics. So I've got something in here about him. He ought to, he really belongs in Sitka, but we also want to make a note about it down here.
This sure.
Year. Down here. I left out two or three names there of people who weren't either, they were inconsequential or they was reasons for leaving them out.
Have most of the physicians that have come here to practice stayed on?
Yeah, most of them have.
Because this, that's quite different than Fairbanks.
No, most of them have. I remember, no longer in the 1950s, one young fellow who came from Ketchikan, very bright guy, but he'd inherited some money. He came up here and his wife didn't like it, and so after a year away he left and went down there, one of the suburbs of Seattle, where he's doing very well. He wasn't here long enough to make any difference. There was a Canadian about that time who was here for 6 months or so, as I remember, and he disappeared. There was one who was here for about 5 years. Along late in the 1950s, along in there, he must have been here 4 or 5 years. He said he had been a missionary in Vietnam, and that he had done a great deal of surgery out there. Well, he bought out when the doctor Zero was leaving. And the next thing we knew, either Dr. Salas or I, one or the other of us had to help him out on a case where it was quite evident that he didn't know what he was doing. The next thing, the other doctor helped him out, and again it was quite obvious that he didn't know what he was doing. And so we just got this young man and said, "Now look, you just have to stop doing any surgery. That's all there is to it. No more of this for you, or you're right off the staff." Well, he just couldn't understand. He'd operated on 500 women out in Vietnam who had ectopic pregnancies, and they'd all gotten well. And so we said, "Well, anatomy of the Vietnamese women must be different from the kind that they have here, but you're through. There's no more abdominal surgery for you." So that took care of that. For a year or two, he behaved himself very well, and then he started doing a little accident work. In the emergency room, soap somebody who had a few cuts. But he didn't get into any trouble until all at once, when he had a woman come in who had tried to commit suicide before by slashing her wrists. but hadn't succeeded. And so this time, she slashed her throat. And he went ahead and sewed her up. Now, maybe you're familiar with this, or maybe not, but always in any neck surgery, you have to be very careful to get the blood vessels tied off. Otherwise, they can keep on bleeding, and if they keep on bleeding and the wound is sewed shut, you got a great big clot in here and you can choke to death.
Hmm.
And so this is what happened to her. They found her in the morning choked to death, and so we just said, now look, buddy, you're through. I know. That I didn't mention him, because he disappeared a long time ago. And then after he left, you know, after he left, the narcotics people came around to asking questions about him. And he went from here to Idaho. Tried to get a license through there, and we just said, no, this is what happened. This man was on his behalf. He left in a hurry. Narcotics people came up looking for him. So I think we got one other request from Sacramento, and then that is all. That was, must have been almost 20 years ago. Now this guy was a, he sure was a charmer. I never had seen anybody manipulate two women at the same time and get away with it. His wife, of course, he didn't take her any place. But here was a good-looking redhead in town who had a couple of children. And he was cozying up to her. I remember she came in the office to us to complain and wanted us to get his license taken away from him. We had to say, well, you'll have to get out and get a complaint and fill it out, sign your name to it. I can't send anything, any letter up there to Juno unless you do that. Of course, she didn't do that. And then the next thing we knew, not only was the redhead going out to them, but here was another good-looking woman who'd sit in his car and wait for him every afternoon when he got through at the hospital. They'd say, here were two of them that he had on a string at the same time.
Do you suspect he was a bogus physician, that he didn't actually have any training?
I don't know. Anyway. Back there, when I came up here, of course the license laws were rather, well, I was going to say they were lax. I'll put it this way: when somebody came in the territory, if he looked all right, you'd give him a temporary license and say, now by December 31st, you get your exam. That was done quite often, and I know what we sometimes it takes a couple of years to find out about a person before they left. I don't remember any disasters that ever happened because of it. But
were you involved at all with the State Medical Association?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, I helped get the pasteurization law through for for Ketchikan. I helped get that through. That was 1938. We had a epidemic of indolent fever from a dairy out here. And the Board of Health from Juneau, well, one of their men, I think his name was Carswell, came down to help us get that passed. So we got the milk taken care of at that time, got that pasteurized. The water, 1938, the water situation took until 1952. Now, for 20 years, we've been telling the town that with these big storms, the seagulls fly from waterfront to the lake, paddle around in the lake. They wouldn't pay any attention to that. Finally, the health department got permission to have some seagulls killed. We had an epidemic here. 1952, it was when they were building the tunnel down here. And they killed some seagulls, and they found the same intestinal organisms in the seagull, the same salmonella that we were getting at the hospital. So then the town council and the KPU board, public utilities board, decided to go ahead. But they put it off as long as they could. The next thing we knew was they'd made arrangements for the city of Vancouver water department and their water engineer to come up here and look at our lake before they did this, because they said that the city of Vancouver didn't have their watershed covered over. They wanted to get out of it. Well, this guy came up and looked around. He just said to the council, "No, you people are just lucky. You better get busy and get that water chlorinated right away." And so we finally did. Then I was on the State Board of Health here for a while. And I helped draw up the first basic science law. And I was president of the association about 1945, I think. And then, then I went back to delegate for a couple of years.
You were president of the Alaska State Medical Association?
Alaska Territorial.
Territorial, yeah.
And I went to San Francisco and to New Jersey, to Atlantic City. Did you ever go to one of those big auctions?
Auctions?
Yeah.
No.
Well, that week there at Atlantic City, I was quite busy till I got down to the last night, and I said, "Gee whiz, why do I want to go to this banquet here tonight? I think I'd have a lot more fun if I disappear and go to on the boardwalk and go to one of these auctions." So I did. And I found out very fast that you had to be very careful in one of those places. You didn't want to rub your nose the wrong way or wiggle your ears or do something else, or you'd give a signal that you were buying something. But it is a lot of fun. I just sat there and watched it, and but they finally, they weren't selling anything. They had some beautiful rugs there, and they were getting a nipple on them, and so this auctioneer started getting huffy, you know, and And he decided he was going to have a raffle, and they raffled some little glass things about this big, and I put down a dollar, and so help me, I won one. So my wife was quite happy with that. Oh gosh.
Well, maybe I'd better let you go to bed. And
what do you want to go over still? Do you want to take this along and look at it tonight?
Yeah.
All right. Take it along and look at it, and then we can go over it, and you can ask me anything else that you want.
In the morning.
Yeah.
Good. Now this is the end of tape 2 of the interview with Dr. Wilson.